Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
BP wants to deepen its partnerships with Middle Eastern countries, which has the U.S. government asking, wait, where does that leave oil spill victims in this country? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, welcome to the show. I'm Bill Radke, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, July 7th. BP's chief executive, Tony Hayward, was in Abu Dhabi today, visiting the crown prince of that wealthy emirate. And you can understand why Hayward needs money. The company's cleanup costs for the Gulf oil spill are above $3 billion, and that doesn't count a $20 billion fund for damages. So Hayward is touring the Middle East and other places, asking rich countries to invest or keep investing. And apparently this is not just BP's problem. It turns out the U.S. Justice Department is also taking a special interest in these meetings, as Chrissy Clark reports.
In polite British fashion, Hayward left Abu Dhabi with a thank you. Right before boarding a plane, he told reporters he was delighted to meet with our long-term partners and friends. But analyst and oil expert Stephen Lieb says the underlying goal of Hayward's charm tour isn't good manners, it's good investors who could buy stock that's currently a bargain.
Tony Hayward is very, very interested, if not desperate, in getting an investor in British Petroleum for fear that it will be a takeover candidate if he doesn't find a major buyer of some stock.
Any investment could also help BP cover oil spill damages. That's a good thing. But there's a bad scenario, too, one that the Department of Justice has an interest in avoiding. Late last month, the DOJ demanded that BP let them know in advance about any plans of asset sales. The department did not return calls for comment, but their request to BP isn't a normal one. Then again, this isn't a normal situation, as Rachel Ziemba explains. She's an analyst at Rubini Global Economics.
They want to make sure that BP wouldn't restructure in such a way that it would try to avoid paying these claims and leave the federal government and the U.S. taxpayer to pay all the costs.
While that's a far-fetched scenario, analyst Stephen Lieb says it's not impossible, especially given the Mideast countries BP has been courting.
If the Saudis or Libya got 6 or 7% of BP, and in exchange for that had board control of the company, that might be an issue. That really might be an issue because, you know, they would have, you know, reverse leverage against us because we really are dependent on their oil.
Meanwhile, the next stop on Tony Hayward's fire sale tour is Angola. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Today, President Obama appointed the man who will run Medicare and Medicaid, two of the biggest landmines in the federal budget. Now, normally the Senate would have to confirm the appointment, but when the president first nominated Donald Berwick back in April, Republicans blasted, some say distorted, Berwick's views on cutting health care costs. Clearly, he was not going to make it through a confirmation process, so today the president got around the Senate by using what's called a recess appointment. Marketplace's John Dimsdale says the challenge over Berwick's nomination is nothing compared to what he will face on the job.
Health reform counts on savings from Medicare and Medicaid. The new law offers incentives for hospitals and doctors to deliver better quality services more efficiently and punishes those that don't. Donald Berwick's appointment was praised by many in the healthcare industry, including Chip Kahn of the Federation of American Hospitals.
He's actually gotten into hospitals to improve care at the grassroots level. Don's been there, you know, and Don's done it.
Berwick is a pediatrician, a Harvard professor, and heads a think tank dedicated to efficient healthcare delivery. His opponents in the Senate fear the only way he can cut costs is by rationing services to Medicare and Medicaid recipients. But Robert Berenson, a former Medicare-Medicaid official during the Clinton administration, says there are other ways to reduce costs.
There's just too many studies that show that there's wasted spending, that it wouldn't be rationing to reduce spending for the things that don't serve anybody's purposes.
But Joseph Antos at the American Enterprise Institute worries Berwick's aggressive push for healthcare efficiency could lead him to withhold necessary medical services.
He has a very long record of statements and actions that indicate that he really believes that we should plunge forward with this kind of an approach. Many people are concerned about that.
Berwick's other challenge will be to institute dramatic changes in the delivery of Medicare and Medicaid with an agency that has fewer staffers now than it did in 1980 and has been without an administrator since 2006. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
When President Obama gave his State of the Union address early this year, he made a pledge then. He wanted to double U.S. exports in the next 5 years. Well, today, the president pointed to a 17% increase in exports since then and declared his plan is on track. This is all very interesting because with all of the jobs we've lost overseas in recent years, the common perception is America no longer produces much that we can export. So we asked our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, what do we have to sell?
Some of the country's top brands are represented on the Special Advisory Panel on Exports appointed by the president today. It includes 18 business and labor leaders, among them the CEOs of Boeing, Ford, Disney, Pfizer, Dow Chemical, and MetLife. The president says growing exports of American products and services will lead to job growth and economic recovery.
95% of the world's customers and fastest-growing markets are beyond our borders. So if we want to find new growth streams, if we want to find new markets and new opportunities, we've got to compete for those new customers.
Analysts have recently reported increasing demand overseas for U.S.-produced food, automobiles, and semiconductors. But goods from smaller companies like building supply firms are also in demand, and the administration says it intends to promote more exports from smaller businesses. At the National Federation of Independent Business, Chief Economist Bill Dunkelberg says that help is welcome as far as it goes.
We're not really heavily engaged directly in exporting, although many small manufacturing firms are in the supply chain of the large companies that are on the president's council. But the big firms are really the ones that do the large share of exporting, and they are the ones really in a position to help double our exports.
But many experts remain skeptical of the president's promise. Daniel Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. He says doubling U.S. exports in 5 years will take a lot of cooperation from trading partners and a lot of economic luck.
They can't will it by themselves. I mean, it might actually happen, no matter what they say, if the global economy recovers to the point where our exports recover.
Although skeptical, the experts don't deny the potential for growth is real, and with exports so low, doubling the number is relative. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Buying and not selling was the rule on Wall Street today, and we'll have the happy details when we do the numbers. What will the BP oil spill cost? If you thought of a dollar figure, well, you're really not even close to the real costs. It is a life-changing event, and the psychological toll, it's going to be unknowably big. The state of Louisiana is asking BP to help pay for mental health counseling for residents hit by the spill. There is a New Orleans call center called ViaLink that tells people where they can get counseling and other disaster relief services. Richard LaPrat runs the place. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you.
Since the oil started leaking, your agency has logged 1,600 phone calls, but they're for logistical help. Only 15 people asked for mental health counseling. So why do you think there will be more of a need for this kind of counseling?
There's a lot of different factors into play right now where the oil is pretty much starting to come onto the beaches. It's not something that's directly affecting individuals as such, but the oil is affecting the fishing business, it's affecting the small livelihoods that you see of the fishermen in the areas, and it's going to start affecting them even more as it creeps more and more onto the beaches and creeps more and more into the lives of the individuals that live here in this state.
And how is that slow-moving nature of the problem, how is that psychologically different for people?
Well, if you look at it in comparison to Katrina, Katrina came in and was gone within a couple of days. People were able to recover. They were able to see what was actually happening. They were actually able to look and rebuild and take a look at the steps that were needed to be taken to make sure their future was actually going to be secure. With this slow-moving disaster, it's ongoing. It's almost torture to watch every single day a new aspect of this disaster hitting our coast, hitting and affecting the people and the businesses and the tourism in the area. It's constantly here, and it's constantly getting worse. So mentally, that drains individuals. You know, after a while, you start getting burnt out on hearing about it. You start getting burnt out on the effects that it's having on your lives. It starts getting to be a complete disaster, both for physical as well as for mental health needs.
What kind of mental health counseling do you think people will need?
You're going to start seeing more family and children support needed. That would be more counseling for families. You're going to start seeing more domestic violence issues as well as substance abuse issues that may occur from those individuals that are most affected. You may see crime increase because of the fact that these individuals have nothing else, you know, available to them, or they may be desperate. You're going to start seeing an agitation as well as an escalation of these types of events as we creep further and further into this long-term disaster.
A lot of the people suffering the most are commercial fishers. Is that a culture you've dealt with much?
The fishermen, you know, they basically rely upon their own. They have their own community. This is a very proud community. Now all of a sudden this disaster has come into play and affected their entire lives and their livelihoods. And many of these individuals have never reached out for help before. They may or may not know where to go. They may or may not know what is available to them if they should reach out. So there's a bit of confusion on the part of the population, as well as kind of the worry or the impatience with what's actually going to be given to them. You're starting to see the fishing areas being restricted. You're starting to see various aspects of life here in the state of Louisiana being directly affected. There's a lot of unknowns here, and those are the things that are really going to start paring away at the human mind, if you will.
I've been talking with Richard LaPrat. He directs the Via Link call center in New Orleans. They help people find logistical support and mental health counseling after disasters. Richard, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Drive to increase American exports might get a little help from the weather. The U.S. is the world's biggest supplier of cotton, and this wet spring and dry summer should make it a good year for cotton growers here. Now, when it comes to the best cotton in the world, that is another matter. As you know, it is the phrase Egyptian cotton on a towel or a sheet that will automatically raise the price. And who's doing the hard work of harvesting Egypt's precious cotton? Reporter Julia Simon tells us, in many cases, it's children.
60 miles south of Cairo, the desert gives way to the fertile agricultural oasis of El Fayoum. I met 13-year-old Mohammed there, and he took me into the cotton fields. He stoops over to show me the plant's yellow flowers. Cotton picking doesn't begin until the end of the summer, so now is the time for maintenance of the crop, pulling weeds and picking worms off the plants. Mohammed, who's worked the field since he was 10, says he sprays the plants with a backpack full of pesticide.
When the plant is little, we spray it because of the worms and weeds and stuff. We put the pesticide on our backs and we walk like this.
He makes the sound of spraying and he and his friends laugh. Mohammed wasn't the youngest child I met here. Five-year-old Brince began cleaning weeds from the cotton when he was 4. He makes a little under a dollar for a few hours of labor. Zaima Korsun-Neff of Human Rights Watch says when children work in agriculture,
they may be working long hours in the hot sun without enough water to drink. They often do the same motions over and over again. And children may develop back pain, neck pain, wrist pain, the complaints of a much older adult.
When I told Korsun-Neff about Mohammed spraying the pesticide on the cotton, she said that was very disturbing.
Long-term exposure to pesticides is associated with brain damage, with hormonal disruptions. The fact is, children should not be handling or applying pesticides. It's simply too dangerous for them.
In Cairo, I went to the Egyptian Ministry of Agriculture, a large colonial villa with a grand marble staircase, to put these concerns to Amina Baza, the Minister of Agriculture. He said that Egypt has strict laws governing child labor.
By law, anybody under 15 cannot really find work in the fields. This is by law, it's forbidden.
I told the minister that I had met children working in the cotton fields under the age of 15.
Where is that?
In El Fayoum.
If the parents are sending their children to work for a fee, don't think that the government can do something about it.
Abaza did make a point of saying that children in the cotton fields are not working with dangerous machinery.
As long as they are not in jeopardy, I don't think that we have to worry, especially if it's in the vacations, summer vacations or something like that.
Back in El Fayoum, most of the children I met were students, except for Dina. At 13 years old, she has never gone to class. She says the worst part of cotton farming is the foreman.
They hit us. If we do something wrong, they hit us. And if we come late, like an hour late, they hit us.
The problem, says Naveen Osman of the World Food Program, is enforcement. She says small farms are exempt from government scrutiny, and the vast majority of Egypt's cotton farms are under 5 acres.
The labor inspectors do not have the authority to inspect the work of the child in small farms to stop or to monitor the hazards the child is exposed to or to combat child labor.
Osman currently heads a campaign against child labor in Egypt, and one of her project's goals is to help Egypt update its list of hazardous occupations. If agriculture is added to the list, then labor inspectors can start going onto these small farms where the children are. Before I left El Fayoum, I asked Dina what she wanted to be when she grew up. I'd choose to be a doctor or an engineer, she said. Her foreman from the cotton fields was laughing at her. They're farmers, the foreman said. In El Fayoum, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
You can see the children you just met. We have photos from Julia's trip to the Egyptian cotton farm at our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, you can keep the job, but you have to move.
And when faced with this decision to stay employed, but really sever all those links, you know, that's obviously not that easy to make that decision.
First, we're going to do the numbers. Hope for a second quarter earnings season that's actually pretty strong lit a fire under Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials raced up 274 points, about 2.8% to close at 10,018. The NASDAQ rose 65 points, more than 3% to finish up at 2159. And the S&P 500 added 32 points, also topping 3% to end the day at 1060. Most earnings reports for the second quarter don't start coming in till next week, but institutional investment firm State Street has raised expectations for decent returns. And the company said its earnings should beat Wall Street expectations, and shares zoomed up nearly 10%. Bonds fell today. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.98%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the new Harvard Business Review. The July-August issue is on newsstands now, featuring an in-depth interview with Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its monthly report on consumer credit. Are folks out shopping? Chain stores report sales for June. And nominations for the Primetime Emmy Awards are announced in Los Angeles. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke, in for Kai Ryssdal. As we heard earlier in the show, President Obama wants to double U.S. exports. He says export jobs are one way we can sail out of our economic doldrums. Our conservative commentator David Frum sees another partial way out of our troubles. He's just not sure the Republican Party wants to hear it.
The June jobs numbers were dreadful, down 125,000. Maybe it's just a blip. The end of the census sent a lot of workers home. But there are other signs that the jobs numbers will continue bad over the next while. Consumer confidence plunged in June after 3 months of rising optimism. Job creation in the private sector was only one-third its April level. Conditions in the housing market continue grim. The Obama administration is fretting over what to do next. More aid to states? Some kind of second stimulus? Or just hang on and hope for the best? My own Republican Party is equally perplexed. It opposes more government spending. It wants the Bush tax cuts extended. But the Bush tax cuts are in place now, and they do not seem to have helped very much through these terrible 2 years. I have a suggestion. I think we should overcome our inhibitions and rediscover the positive side of inflation. I know. I'm a child of the 1970s, too. I remember when menus came with little stickers affixed in a stack atop the original price. I remember crazed auction rooms where bidders scrambled to buy something, anything, with their depreciating currency, paintings, suits of armor, Austro-Hungarian postage stamps. But as awful as double-digit inflation was, single-digit deflation is worse. As triumphant as the victory over inflation was, we can't always be refighting the last war. This is a country deeply in debt. Inflation reduces the burden of debt, anonymously, impersonally, and across the board. I hope I don't sound too nationalistic when I note that a lot of that debt is held by our Chinese friends. They ran huge trade surpluses with the United States when times were good. Time now for them to contribute a little back. Nobody wants to see wheelbarrows of money at the grocery store. But 3% inflation? 4%? There are worse things.
Commentator David Frum is the editor of Frum Forum. I imagine you remember inflation. How would you feel about a return? Let us know about anything you hear on our program at marketplace.org. Just click on the link that says Contact. You can find all of David Frum's commentaries on our site, and you can sign up for his new podcast. General Motors says it is starting to turn out more cars and trucks at its factories. Still, the company is downsizing. In Shreveport, Louisiana, a GM plant is preparing to close, and employees who aren't retiring are forced to choose: lose your job or transfer to a plant someplace elsewhere in the country. Red River Radio's Kate Archer Kent reports that can be an excruciating decision.
Skeletons of pickup trucks glide along this conveyor belt. Rosie Salinas handles quality control and is monitoring her computer screen for little red boxes. One pops up indicating a shoulder harness isn't properly attached.
So then I go to that vehicle and I fix it, and then I come back and put it in that it's been repaired.
Salinas has worked here for 13 years, and her career with GM is coming to an end. The Shreveport plant could close at any time in the next 2 years. GM doesn't have a breakdown of who accepts transfers and who ultimately is laid off. Salinas has chosen not to transfer for the sake of her 14-year-old daughter.
To start high school with new friends, to try to make new friends, would be devastating for her, so I'm not going to put her through something like that.
But her coworker Chris Antosik acted fast, putting in for a transfer. He didn't want to take a chance losing his job. This is his last day at the Shreveport plant. The 1,000 workers here can choose from several dozen plants around the country as positions open up. Antosik is moving to a stamping plant in Marion, Indiana.
It's going to be tough leaving, and I didn't want to leave. But sometimes when the writing's on the wall, you got to use your head, not your heart then.
4 years ago, Antosik transferred to Shreveport. He thought it would be a stable move for him and his wife, a GM contract worker.
With the Hummer product, as well as was running 4 years ago in the Canyon in Colorado, we thought we'd be able to come down here and retire from this plant with ease, but, you know, that's out of our control.
Professor Wendy Boswell studies employee turnover at Texas A&M University's Human Resource Management Center. She says it used to be that people were wedded to their jobs, willing to move anywhere for the company, but now hometown ties often keep workers grounded.
We have people with commitments to their community, their churches, relationships, and when faced with this decision to stay employed, but really sever all those links, you know, that's obviously not that easy to make that decision.
Rosie Salinas still lies awake at night wondering if she made the right decision. She missed out on her kids' after-school activities while working the night shift for many years. She didn't want to transfer to Arlington, Texas, and only see them on weekends. She hopes the family can scrape by on her husband's salary in beverage sales.
I know it's the right decision, but, you know, it's still a battle. I don't know what my future holds.
The plant's personnel director, Paul Emond, calls the choice between transferring and staying the fatal decision. And he should know. He's been with GM for 41 years and has been transferred many times.
On the salaried side, you don't always get an option. We usually get told your next job on Monday is okay. It becomes one of those, do you become stagnant or do you continue to grow and develop and use all of the things that you've kind of grown and developed with?
In this case, he was transferred to Shreveport to close the plant down, and what he does next is up to GM. In Shreveport, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And here's a final note today. There has been some debate about whether the Gulf of Mexico oil spill should have been foreseen. Well, somebody did foresee it. Eerily so. A 1970s board game has surfaced. It was called BP Offshore Oil Strike. It had the official BP logo right on it. And the game was players would compete to find oil in the water, and they had to draw hazard cards, one of which read blowout, rig damaged, oil slick cleanup costs, pay $1 million. Okay, so they were a little off with the price tag. But wait a minute. This was a British board game. Why were the damages listed in American dollars anyway? And that's really eerie. Well, that board game is suddenly valuable. You can buy it on eBay, and you can see it at our website, marketplace.org. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, how about the Dow zooming up 274 points, 2.8%. The NASDAQ rose 65 points. That was more than 3%. And the S&P 500 scooted up 32 points, also more than 3%. The people who engineer this show are Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe. Tune in tomorrow to My People, Marketplace Morning Report. They will give you the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, building a business based on 140 characters.
We have an explicit goal not to make Twitter an antidote to information overload, not a source of it.
We'll talk to the doctors with the antidote, Twitter founders Biz Stone and Evan Williams. I'm Bill Radke. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.